Dargraith Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for summer semester 2014. Lecture 14, delivered on July 24, 2014. The title of this lecture is Radical Economics of the Left.
Tonight, the last lecture of the semester. As of this lecture, I have been taking you down the road of traditional Western economics pedagogy. Although in the last couple of lectures I was showing a few of the issues that are involved in the arguments against the typical capitalist economic model, it's been, for the most part, a long journey in Western economics, the economics of conservative thinkers. And I'll start with one. Early in the course, I brought up it was the first lecture, I brought up Adam Smith, father of modern economics and all of that. But actually, I can trace back further than Adam Smith some of the fundamental concepts that were the basis of the economic model that is pursued by countries in the Western Hemisphere and other places in the world. Take you back to a philosopher of the early 18th century, the early 1700s, named John Locke, capital L-O-C-K-E, John Locke. Now, John Locke was talked about a lot of things. He wrote about a lot of things, but he centered on this idea that had been batted around for a long time. What makes a person a person? He was of the opinion, which was rather kind of common in that time, that there was nothing of a person that when the person came into being. It was like a blank tablet. And everything that we are comes through our experiences. We are the sum of the things that we have learned from the outside world, from classrooms, from other people. It goes along with another idea, controversial perhaps, that all knowledge is injunctive. In other words, we know nothing that we are not told. We don't have any born in us thinking. There were some pretty grueling experiences of people who were experimented on in the a long, long time ago, where they scientists or natural philosophers were trying to figure out if there was anything that people were born with. As a matter of fact, they kept some people in, from the time they were born, in isolated rooms to see if there was anything that was human about them that would come out. Like, did people have a natural language? If you don't expose a child to a language, does a language still come out? That would be something interesting if it did. But for the most part, it seemed at the time that there really wasn't anything that was an essence of a person that was aside from experiences. But therein lies an interesting thing, because all of us have a limited experiential world. None of us see everything. None of us see even a tiny, tiny fraction of everything, which means that essentially, whatever we are pretty darned ignorant. And we could be rational, which Adam Smith argued, but whatever rationality we have is bounded by our experiences in life. And no one has some huge godlike body of experience, so we're all in this position where we don't have a whole lot to go on. We're kind of ignorant, and within that ignorance, we try to pursue our rational self-interest, but that's not all that great. John Locke went on several different tracks in his life. He was fascinated with the idea of empiricism, the experiences of life. Collecting data, we do it through our lives, and that's how we learn, that's how we become more. He was also one of those philosophers in the early Age of Reason who talked about a social contract. A social contract. When you're born, you belong to a society. There is not a you without a society. Notwithstanding the occasional wild animal kid who's brought up by wolves or whatever, but even there, brought up in a society, we are social animals. Our entire world experience is through the lens of a society of some kind, which means that there is no such thing as man and then society. There is you in the context of society. You are drawn on a piece of paper called your society. And so we are born into, all of us are born into a social contract. We are all bound by it. Notwithstanding those who say, well, I ain't part of no contract I didn't sign. Yes, you are. This is that one contract that is the exception to all contracts. You are bound to it by virtue of the fact that you were born into the society. Now, you might want to say, well, I can move to another society. Well, fine. You engage another social contract. But you certainly don't have no contract. Wherever you go, you're going to be bound. Well, I'm going to go out and live in the woods like Henry David Thoreau did. I will live deliberately. I will not pay taxes. I will live next to my pond, and I will drink the water out of the pond into which I have urinated. Well, there's your manly man. But he was doing that in reaction to a society. He was part of the society. He was a contrarian of the society, but he was part of it. And his only contribution to the human experience was by describing what he had learned by being the contrarian to the social contract. He wasn't apart from the social contract. He imagines himself a breacher of it. He didn't deny it. By virtue of the fact that he said, I have left to go live alone, he had conceded that he was in it, and he was fighting it. So John Locke begins his arguments on political philosophy. Well, a large part of what he talked about was the fact that we are in this social contract. And I'll bring that up in a minute again with a later philosopher who was quite a bit different from Locke. He came to different conclusions. But Locke said, look, let's talk about rights. Now, he, as philosophers and politicians and thinkers for millennia, had been arguing, saw that there were fundamental rights. We hold that these rights are unalienable. Interestingly enough, if you read through Locke's work, and believe me, early 1700s philosophical writings are grueling, even when they're in English. But I mean, at the heart of it, you will see over and over again, wait a minute, I saw that, I remember that, that was in the Declaration of Independence. How could that have been there? Locke was that influential that quite a few decades after his death, he was still influencing revolutionaries like the ones who founded our country. Our founders of our country, the rebels of the time, said, we have these unalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That comes from Locke. What also comes from Locke is this interesting idea that we draw one of those rights that inheres to us. As part of our social contract is private property rights. The fruits of our labor are ours. That's private property. What we own is ours. It doesn't belong to a king or even to a god. It belongs to us. And as part of that also, as an extension, interestingly enough, is that no government is legitimate that does not draw its power from the consent of the governed. That's part of our property rights. It's not something they can take away from us unless they decide that they are no longer worth being a legitimate government among the nations of the earth. We have these rights, and one of them is the property right. The right to have this private thing. And Adam Smith would pursue that greatly. He said, look, you give those property rights. Okay, I shouldn't say give. A government cannot give a right. It is false to say the Constitution grants us these rights. That is bullcrap. The Constitution enumerates some of the rights, it recognizes rights, and it gives a blanket statement at one point, well, if we haven't mentioned these, well, they're still there. But a government can't grant you rights. But among those rights is this right to property, private property. And from that right, as Adam Smith would argue, we can do with it what we want. And if we are really rational beings, bounded or whatever, we are going to do what is best for ourselves with that. Trashing it, ruining it, wasting it really is not a rational thing to do, and most people won't do it. They will exploit it for its greatest benefit. That was Adam Smith's argument for a free market with private property rights intimately respected, consistently respected. You can't bother people when they are using their private property. You can't take it away from them unless you want to wipe out the legitimacy of your government anyway. Because if people are allowed to use their property as they choose, they will probably, if they're rational, most of them, unless they're really crazy, they're going to produce with it. They're going to make it productive for their own benefit. And if we allow everyone to do that, according to Adam Smith, the society will be at its best. Resources that are privately owned will be used as efficiently as they can. That is static efficiency. Over time, new technologies will be developed so that we can use those resources even more efficiently. That's dynamic efficiency. And why are we doing that? Because it is in our interest to do that. You are the bread maker. You made the bread, but you were lazy. You wasted resources. So you and your greed, using your own private property, just use the resources a little better. Static efficiency. You waste stuff. And you do that not because you love customers, you want to make the world better, you do it for your own self-interest. And you don't care what happens to her. You sorry, greedy capitalist. But over time, you are going to say, well, maybe I could find a different way to use my factors of production. Make this bread even cheaper. Not because you want customers to have cheap bread, but because you want to take away the business from someone else and have it for yourself. And if I let you have your private property and let you do with it what you will, I will grant you that you are a rational person. You're going to figure out some way, or someone is, to make the bread cheaper so you can take his business and ruin them because you don't care about them. Care is almost like a weakness in this regard. We can care about our family, care about our pets, our God, whatever. But in the business world, what we care about is making our private property as productive as possible. You're not in this college for the love of country, for the love of knowledge. You're not in my class because you love yourself economics. Matter of fact, most of you would probably rather set your face on fire and beat it out with an iron skillet than take an economics course. But at the same time, your private property, your person, is enhanced by what you are doing here. And you are doing it not so that you can make everyone else, the whole nation, better, not so you can make me happy by looking bright and happy, bright and perky in class. You're doing it because you want to make more money. You wouldn't be doing this for another reason. Unless, of course, someone's threatening to kill you if you don't go to college. Some parents are like that.
That's me.
Mm-hmm. I know more than a few were like that. And on, in this process, it doesn't mean that you're going to have just crappy production. You're going to have an efficiency that ensures that the products are not terrible, because if you kill people with your products, then you have done nothing. You've lost the business. Over time, customers will walk away because you've killed them with your food that you've made or one of the machines that you produce. So clearly there is an incentive not only to produce, but to produce in such a way that the product has at least some degree of minimal quality. The social contract concept. And I'm going to use a term here for philosophers who worked in this concept of a social contract. We call them contractarians. And they come in different, very different philosophical model, thinking modes. But John Locke had this idea of the social contract, and also the fundamental importance of private property. You earn money, you get to keep that money. You have a piece of land, that's yours, not someone else's. Do with it whatever you want. He also had this idea of the natural rights of people. And again, emphasizing that, our founding fathers were heavily influenced by John Locke and the men who had come before him, the philosophers who had come before him, all the way back through history. So if you ever hear, well, our government gives us this right, or our Constitution grants us this right, explain right away, no one grants me a right. The right inheres to me as a natural consequence of the social contract. In other words, it inheres to me by virtue of the fact that I was born. Not because the government is going to be nice to me. Not because I have money so that I can buy myself more rights. No. It comes to me because of the social contract. And the social contract binds me to the society because I was born in that society. And I am not going to even try to defend the idiots who claim I didn't sign no contract, so I ain't part of it. You are part of it. And that would be agreed to by John Locke, by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and by others, even though their political philosophies were highly different. But let me take you a little bit. On. Trying to think of how I would want to put this. Well, let me reel you forward in time a little farther. Now, John Locke was active in the from the late 1600s until the early 1700s. Now, if you reel forward, you have Adam Smith starting to step into the field of the philosophers, and others along the way too, jumping into this whole debate and whole thinking mode about social contract, the role of the person and the society. Understand that since time immemorial in high civilizations, the argument had always come down to the rulers draw their legitimacy from God. And the power of the empire to impose its will on the people merely reflects the power of the God flowing through those he has chosen on earth to enforce his will. As one French king would say, l'état c'est moi, I am the state. Others, there was always this pull down from God to the rulers, and everyone under the rulers was subject to the rule of God as it was articulated through those powerful rulers and the church that supported them. Now, this is not true just of Christianity. You can find the same concept of a separation of rule from the governing, governance from the governed, in quite a few religions across the world. Not in all, but in many of the high ones. We can go back to the ideas of the early Judaic philosophers. At first, there was sort of a there was more than one God, and there were some who were quite beneficent, and they saw the entire family unit as having a legitimacy that was incredibly powerful in the community's life, embodied perhaps in the goddess Asherah. But as the group, as I would call it, the cult of Yahweh, began to take its hold, you saw this head god, a male head god, begin to take form, not just in the Judeo tradition. You saw it also in Greece, God the Father, Zeus Pater, and then in the Jupiter, Zeus Pater, Jupiter, this father, powerful, all-seeing, all-controlling figure. This concept of the people down here and the God up here. And the states were modeled on this religious concept. And some would argue that religious concept was modeled on the states that used it. But there was this emerging concept. John Locke had it, and others had it too, that these states are not legitimate. The only legitimacy that would come to a state would be through the consent of the governed, through the people who were going to be the subject of the state. It would eventually come to the point where you would get the communist philosophers who would say that, you see, the only way we can make sure that that is how it works is if the people are the state and the state are the people. The only way you can ensure that there is not this separation of rule from those ruled would be if there is this blanket kind of democracy where everyone participates fully and no one is better than anyone else. Let me take you forward to a French philosopher named Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and this will be in the PowerPoint that associates, so you don't have to spell it right here. Rousseau was 1712 to 1778. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was contractarian. He starts out with this idea that there was a time when man lived in harmony with nature. We were all okay with each other. We were cooperative. But there's a problem with that. You see, because in that state of nature, you would have a legitimate and good love of yourself. But eventually that legitimate, good love of self moves to something darker, pride. And pride sets in, and then you no longer look at the people around you as being your brothers and sisters, but they begin to take on the character of those you compare yourself to, greaters and lessers than yourself. And then as time moves forward, that begins to develop into those who are rulers and those who are subordinates. We begin to move back to that problem that some of the Greek philosophers thought there were golden men and silver men and iron men and all that kind of stuff. Sooner or later, if you start comparing yourself to people around you, you are going to develop pride, and pride will lead you to jealousy, and it will lead to those who think they are better, and they will insist that they are legitimately the rulers. We have to stop that from ever happening. But unfortunately, it already had. Industrialism had seen to it that there would be people with more money and more power, and people with less money and less power. Jean-Jacques Rousseau said that the essential goodness of man had been corrupted. And what had come about was something that was not people. We need to find our way back. As the a satirist Voltaire might have said, "Ah, Jean-Jacques, you imagine that we should return to the trees and live as monkeys." Yes, Rousseau would have said, "Absolutely not. We can do it better because we are people. We are humans. Inherent to us are these natural rights and these sensibilities that can inform us of how to do it well and to ensure that we will not fall from Eden again." Rousseau would go on to push a couple of pretty heavy things on. He said, first of all, the exact opposite is John Locke. He said private property is the fundamental, is the evil that arises. It is the essential evil that arises as the state falls from grace. We start separating ourselves. Private property means that you have yours, I have mine. And I want more of mine at the expense of yours. Don't tell me we can all do better together. If we're going to divide up the land, then in order for me to get more land, I have to take from you. And I look at you, and you have more than me, I become jealous of you. You see that I have less than you, you see me as your lesser in a larger sense. Look at our politicians. How many of them are poor people? They rule us from wealth. Look at the fineries of our churches. How many churches do you see anymore that are in shacks? We see churches that are massive, beautiful. Some churches hung with gold. Their ministers wear the finest of clothing and drive the best of cars and live in the nicest of houses. That is what comes from private property, greed. Greed is not good, as Adam Smith so famously declared. Greed is what will drive us to hurt each other. Instead of cooperating, at the end of the day, in order for me to have more, you have to have less. And especially as we go forward, and there is the pie begin, we can't expand the pie anymore, as Malthus pointed out. In order for me to have something more, I have to take from you. And if it means that I have to kill you, if it means that I have to kill a lot of you, I will. And if my nation wants more, then the way it's going to get more is to go to war. And it's going to take from those who have less capability of waging war. And if I have to kill children, I will do it. And if I have to lie, even though everyone knows it's a lie, I'll do it. Because I want more. Jean-Jacques Rousseau said, look at what we have done to ourselves in this state of disgrace. We go to war. We take from each other. We scheme and plot. We see others as better than ourselves. We aspire to be them, but we can't be them. Rousseau said, first of all, get God out of the government. If people want to practice religion on their own, in their own private homes, whatever. But don't let governments wave a religion in people's faces, because right there they are saying, I have got God on my side and you are my subordinates. Instead of all of us being together, well, there's some of us who are talking to God. Get that out of the way. Second of all, get rid of private property. Because every time you have private property, it degenerates into this take from you, take from me mentality. You can't get around it. It will happen. The capitalist would say, well, that's fine. That's creative destruction. Take from the weaker and give to the stronger and all that kind of stuff. But again, unless you are the very strongest, sooner or later you're going to scream bloody murder because someone more powerful than you has taken from you, all the way up to the government, which now can take away even your most fundamental dignity in your right to privacy. Real forward, a little ways. Humboldt University in Berlin. There was a philosophy professor there, I guess professor would be the name of the teacher, named Georg Hegel, H-E-G-E-L, Hegel. Now, Hegel would, if at first you might think, well, what is he talking about? His writings were terribly obtuse. Even one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century, Bertrand Russell, described Hegel's writings as being opaque, difficult as hell. And I would argue, well, that's just because Hegel wrote his stuff in German. That truly makes for a difficult situation because there are concepts that he wrote about that don't have translations particularly. But look, Hegel wanted to take... He was in a long tradition of philosophers who said, let's get, first of all, some ground rules down about how we're going to think about problems and how we're going to solve problems. And the best way to do that would be to get down to the point where we have simple dualities. We look at things as this versus that. Don't worry, don't do that shades of gray stuff because that's going to just, right away you'll say, it's too complicated. Make it simple to begin with, and then let the complexities that are inside of each simple thing flower so that you can think about them piece by piece. Like, for example, he would say, let's talk about thought versus reality. Don't get more complicated than that. What is thought? What is reality? They're two different things. And how are they different? And then, why are they different? Then we can start looking inside of each one of these things and say, well, what are the differences between these two? Another one you might have had was being versus nothing. And then you look at both of them and you ask yourself, okay, why are these different? And, okay, what do the differences tell us about what are the internal parts of being? What are the internal parts of nothing? I'll get back to that in a minute. Sounds kind of weird. So then we can start matching things up and start thinking more complexly, piece by piece, instead of trying to bite off this massive gray thing on its own. But there's an interesting thing. Once you say being versus nothing, well, nothing is nothing. Maybe there is no such thing as nothing. Oh, once we separate them like that, there might not actually be something that is non-existence. That would be an extension of Hegel. I don't know if he'd be particularly thrilled with me doing that one. He went on. He was very much a part of the age of reason. He said, look, if things exist, then we should be able to know about them. We should be able to understand them. Everything is knowable. Don't tell me about mysteries. Don't say, wave me off. When I ask a question about religion and this contradiction in a religion, don't wave me off and say, well, that's a mystery of the faith. Only God knows. Don't do that to me. Everything is knowable. If everything isn't knowable, why the hell are we here? Why don't we just go and die if there are things that we cannot know? That's our human spirit. That mountain, I wonder what's up at the top of that. Well, it's not knowable. The hell it's not. Climb the mountain and find out. If you die, someone else is going to do it too. Try after you. Why do you keep going back to this? Well, there are some things that aren't knowable. We can know whatever we want. We have human will, free will, and free will means that there is no such thing as unknowable. It is just not known now. But someday, someone will be able to figure out a way to know it. He talked about quite a few things. But he was one of those philosophers who pursued this idea of alienation. And he wanted to think about what separates us from our society, what separates us from each other. He was not quite as, he was certainly not as pie in the sky as Rousseau. Quite honestly, Rousseau was a simplistic thinker. In a lot of ways, he just said, man was once in harmony with nature. Oh, come on, that's just the old Adam and Eve story. That's the Garden of Eden that's in every religion. Don't go there. Hegel didn't. Hegel said, let's get down to some material things. If we're going to philosophize, it's not enough to just philosophize. Let's find out what's going on and how we can apply this to our lives and to the world around us. So he said, okay, first of all, we have these dialectic structures, and that's the idea of breaking things down into two things, one side and the other thing. Dialectic. Okay. And we can analyze problems in terms of this and that, and then look at the internal complexities of each side as a vehicle for seeing how they connect together, the two sides do. Instead of just staring at this mess, we look at the two doors and we see how they're put together, and that tells us how the two sides meld. This took him to the next part, which was something highly influential. He saw historical inevitabilities. Some things are going to happen because that's what they do. You can't cheat. In other words, science doesn't allow you a way to jump off a cliff without any parachute and not be killed. History is the same way. History will have these inevitabilities. We're going down this path. Well, that guess what? That's going to cause this to happen. We invaded a country that was stable politically and economically. It was authoritarian, but we tore it apart, wrecked its government, handed it over to the crazies, and then we stand back here in 2014 and say, well, no one could have ever predicted that that country would turn into a terrorist state run by a bunch of rebels coming in who kill everybody. Well, yes, you could have. Don't lie to yourself. We could have seen it a mile away coming. You beat the drum of war against another empire, and well, spank me Jesus, we're going to end up fighting that other empire. World War I, World War II, the Prussian War, the Boer War, any war you want to talk about begins with rattling your sabers at something that doesn't like to have sabers rattled at it. Historical inevitability. Don't lie to yourself, it will happen. And don't let your politicians tell you that this is different, or that God is on our side this time, or that we're smarter than we were last time. We always get to the same end point. This takes us to the next Hegelian concept in historical inevitability. Remember how I told you that he likes to separate problems into this and that, and then look at the two sides. So he said, okay, let's look at history in a new way. Imagine that you have a dominant idea that pretty much everyone agrees with, or at least that's the controlling paradigm, the controlling mentality. Well, by Hegel's reasoning, everything like that will have inside of it the seeds of its seeds of trouble. No matter what you have, whatever idea you have, it might be the most wonderful idea in the world, but it has the seeds of conflict hiding in it. And as soon as those seeds flower in this lush, beautiful, predominant paradigm, you're going to have a conflict arise because an antithesis will begin. If everyone believes in one idea, sooner or later, you're going to have someone say, FTS, I don't like this. And then you have an antithesis. So in other words, in the Hegelian concept, you will have a thesis that will be everyone, most people, yeah, there it is. Yep, that's how we do it. Might be right. Other places might be right for some, but it ain't for us. We're the Bufords. But even inside of that thesis are the seeds of its own troubles. By its dominance, by the very fact that it is dominant, you are going to get rebellion against it. When everyone agrees that, well, yeah, our country should be run this way, that's about the time when you're going to have some kids start raising hell and saying, hell no, I don't want to do this. When everyone agrees that, for example, the Vietnam War is an important bulwark against communist aggression in Asia and around the world, sooner or later someone's going to say, excuse me, your great idea is getting a whole lot of kids killed. The seeds of destruction were in the very idea itself, that we should prosecute this war because somewhere in there prosecuting a war means people die, and our people die, and then suddenly you have the antithesis come about. The antithesis or antithesis. Thesis and antithesis. And those two clash. And believe me, in my time, the clashes were spectacular. On the civil rights front, well, every good, upstanding person agrees that we can't be giving too many rights to these Negroes. And everyone knows we can't be giving, or we, everyone knows we can't be giving voting rights to women. Women, God. Everyone knows that we can't do these kinds of things. Well, everyone doesn't know that because some people get pissed off because it's assumed everyone knows. The antithesis comes. The civil rights clashes. The anti-war protests. Killing kids at Kent State. Gunning them down, for God's sake. The powers that be, in their thesis, their hubris, their pride, they were the ones who fed the antithesis. The seeds of the destruction were not really even in the antithesis to begin with. They were in the pride, the hubris, the certainty of the thesis itself. That was what Hegel was saying. The antithesis rises as the natural child of the thesis. We'll come back to that in a little bit here. But these two will clash. And sooner or later, out of that process of the clash, will come a synthesis, a new level, a new contract, a new understanding, a new paradigm. But it's a new paradigm, which means it is a thesis. And every thesis will eventually bring an antithesis. And so the synthesis will become a thesis, and it will sow inside of itself the seeds of its antithesis, and the clash will come again, and a new synthesis will rise from that original synthesis. Over and over, the cycle of history proceeds. And you understand this. What we're describing here, Hegel was saying, history, you're taught that history is about conflicts. History is about wars and struggles of people and all that, the great movements of people, the fights for rights and land and political freedom and all that. No, Hegel said history is not about conflict. History itself is conflict. History is conflict. When we look at history, we are not looking at conflicts. We are seeing what history is, what we are. We are not a simple static thing existing in some crystal sphere. We are a dynamic evolution of pain and blood, fighting our way up the ladder. And as we build that ladder up and up and up, we are creating history. We are creating it. History is not about conflict. History is conflict. Now, coming out of Georg Hegel, we had a whole... Hegel was an influential philosopher. and a professor, as oftentimes these strong dynamic figures are. Hegel had controversial things he said. The existence of God was on the table for Hegel. This concept of alienation, people separating, being pulled away from society because what they are in essence is being taken away from them by the state, by these kings and sovereigns, by these industrialists and all this. He was putting forth radical ideas, and they resonated with some of his young students who came to be known as the young Hegelians. I think that's with two L's, sometimes they spell it. The young Hegelians. These were, I'm trying to remember, where in Berlin, at the University in Berlin, that was a hotbed of these young students and protégés of Georg Hegel. And they were sort of like, that place became a magnet for every revolutionary you could imagine. Young kids who wanted to learn this radical idea, these radical ideas. Now, kind of at the core of this was this, were these young Hegelians atheists, they were, which was radical in itself. Gee whiz. I mean, back in that time, questioning the very, not even questioning, just saying there is no God. And we're going to show you why. That was hardcore stuff. Among them was, I would bring up one, Friedrich Feuerbach. He pursued a couple of avenues. He was taking on the Prussian aristocracy, which of course made him real popular with the Prussian aristocracy. And he was taking on the church, and he was taking on the very concept of God. Not God, the concept of God, which goes deeper. He was saying, look, we have created a God who is better than us. This is exactly what the problem is. We initialize a God, and how could we possibly ever be anything but trash? Because our God is always better than us. Somehow, how are we born with the original sin? If we're made in God's image and then we're born with original sin, what are we doing about that? We have to go to this God to ask for forgiveness for what we don't even remember we did. I like to know when I have done something bad before I ask for forgiveness, so I have a good memory of what I did that was bad. But here we are with a religion, with all of these religions that say that we are somehow fundamentally separated from our God because we are but filthy rags, and no matter what we do, in the Bible itself it says your righteousness is but filthy rags unto the Lord. How are we supposed to live with that when we are less than our God? And when those kings, those presidents, those congressmen, those leaders attach themselves to God, what they're doing is they're attaching themselves to the good side, and we are the dirties down here. You can imagine a conversation between Feuerbach and God. God says, who are you to question me? And Feuerbach would come back, I'm your creation. More to the point, you're mine. And now you're no longer going to think of me as dirty in your sight. We're going to replace you with something that won't see us as dirty anymore from the time we're born. That would have been Feuerbach. And understand that that was powerful in the economic realm too. Because what it does is it opens up a kind of political idea that takes away the high-powered, the wealthy. And it takes away the low-powered and the unwealthy. And it says, no one is going to play that game anymore. We can't even conceptualize a governing system that's rule of the majority. Because the majority could be mean. The majority could believe the lies. And as such, if you have a democratic structure of government, you're probably going to have a structure of government that reflects the evils that people believe from the kings, from the corporates, from the industrialists, from the Fox News on the right and the MSNBC on the left. You're going to believe that some people are better than others. You're better if you're a Duck Dynasty person on the right. You're better if you're a scientific evolutionist like Neil deGrasse Tyson on the left. and Carl Sagan. Somehow you're always better than the others around you. We can't let that happen. We can't have a state where there are good people who are better than the bad people, because that's just a new God coming right out at you. There was a fellow, he was a Jewish man, but he had converted to Lutheranism. His father, he wanted to be go into political philosophy and all that, but his father said, no, you got to go into law. But so this guy went to the university, and he ran into the young Hegelians. And, oh, God, he was really hot on this stuff because he thought like them. He is considered one of the young Hegelians. His name is Karl Marx. Karl Marx. Marx was born in 1815, I think it was. He actually didn't go to formal schooling until he was, I think, like 13. Learned very quickly. And he went to university, ran into the young Hegelians when he was 17. And he saw what they were doing as right, as good. And he began to develop his own philosophy based upon the Hegelian principles. Historical inevitability and thinking about problems as dialectic structures. Marx took a little turn from the Hegelian idea. Georg Hegel was a philosopher. You know, he just thought about problems on an abstract level. Even though he tried to think about them on a more firmer basis, he was abstract. Marx said, look, we've got a great way of thinking about problems here. Historical inevitability, using this dialectic method, which, by the way, goes clear back to Aristotle. But he said, we need to turn this to the materiality of human existence. And what is the materiality of human existence? It is economics. So he turned the Hegelian thinking on the economic problem. He said, okay, look, we have around us essentially all of this disparity. We have the wealth, we have the poverty. And in my life, I am seeing the poverty. In 1843, he married a young woman, Jenny Westphalen. Now, Jenny was born of nobility, but she had no money. She was kind of like the black sheep of the family on that side of the family where there wasn't any money. Ultimately, in her life, much later, she would come to have money. But in the early years, she was poor, Marx was poor. And so Marx saw this as sort of his way, his leverage for seeing the disparities of economic life. How those arose from traditional thinking, how those arose from the idea of the Christian God, how that arose from all of these things that come about because we live in a world where there are better people and there are lesser people. Marx and Carl and Jenny struggled greatly. The criticism of Marx is that he sat on his fat ass while Jenny went out and worked. She worked like a dog. She cleaned houses for rich people. She washed their clothes. They lived in abject poverty many times. Marx was in Paris for a while, but then they kicked him out of Paris. Paris was a hotbed of all the revolutionaries of the mid-1800s. Then there was an assassination, so Paris threw Marx and all the other revolutionaries out. He bounced around for a while. He went up to Belgium to collaborate with a guy named Arnold Rouge. But up there, he ran into a young man whose father was a powerful industrialist. The young man was Friedrich Engels, E-N-G-E-L-S. The two of them met, and they began a lifelong collaboration. But even at that, Marx was struggling. His wife was miserable, working all the time. Eventually, they ended up in Soho, in London, living in a two-bedroom apartment that was so cold that one of their kids died from exposure. And they couldn't even didn't even have the money to have the body carted off, so they kept her in the colder room. Jenny went out and begged money to have the child taken away. And I believe a Frenchman took pity on them and gave her the money so that their child could be buried, carted off and buried in a pauper's grave. That had a terrible influence on Marx. Only three of his eight children, I think there were eight, I might be wrong about that, only three of the eight children lived to adulthood. Marx saw this as just the embodiment of what capitalist, industrialist systems do. They don't care that children die. They don't care that people starve. They don't care that you don't do what is best for you. Marx began to develop the communism as a model for economic organization had been around before. But he said, okay, let's sharpen communism. Let's think about what we need to do here. First things first. He saw, like Feuerbach did, this alienation process. Look, when you are hired for a job, that person who is making money off you, the owner of the enterprise, the bourgeoisie, as he called them, the controllers of capital, the money, they are using your labor to make them richer. They are saying, your very essence is my vehicle to another boat, another house, to more power over you. In other words, as time goes on, they acquire their wealth on your back. And they just sit back and they exploit you. And then they promise you your stupid little paycheck if you're a good little boy. How dare you question my wealth, my right to the money? How dare you do that? If you do, I'll just get rid of you. I'll fire you. Marx said, work is one of the most fundamental of all of our essences. Food, sex, and work. Those are the basis of humanity. And they're telling you that you can't have your work if you aren't a good little boy. If you don't cooperate with that giant machine in this room, I'm not supposed to have coffee while that computer's around. I might hurt the little feelings of that coffee. By the time you are 30 years old, you will be working with robots that walk and talk and interact with you and boss you around. In other words, in your lifetimes, you will be a robot's bitch. And you're supposed to take that when you are the ones who are the human beings with the inalienable right. Marx said, this is what creates alienation, because we're going to promise you some private property. We'll give you a little piece of land, and you can put a fence around it. And you know what else you can have? You can have a little house with walls and a door that you can lock. And in that house, you can have a room. You can close the door, and you can have yourself a TV so that you can live in a fantasy world that doesn't really exist. All if you do things according to the way the better people who are connected to God tell you to. But if you're a bad boy, well, even if you're not a bad boy, you know, if economic times get bad, we'll pink slip your ass. Well, I'm sorry, you know. How could they possibly have the hubris to take away your job because they screwed up the economy? Did you screw up the economy in 2007? Was that your job? Did you do that? No. Okay, you know, I know a lot of other people, they didn't do that, but they lost their homes, their jobs, their pensions, everything. They paid the price for the screw-ups of the capitalists, the bourgeois. And then you have the middle class still believing that they can, if they support the bourgeoisie, then they'll get there someday too. They'll get their McMansion in Sarasota. They'll get their food. They'll get their McCars if they support. If the lawyers prosecute for the government, if the lawyers give you pretend help in criminal charges that the sovereign brings against you, if the doctors do the medicines that are handed to them by the giant multinational pharmaceutical companies, if they do all that, then maybe they will be part of the bourgeoisie someday. And all that's left is the proletarians. That's you. And we'll exploit your asses. We'll lie to you. We'll keep you believing that there's an American dream you can live. But the problem is, Hegel already said, the seeds of destruction are there. Marx said, it's a cycle of capitalism. You are going to get out from under this sooner or later. The seeds of destruction embedded within the capitalist system itself will bring it down in a revolution, in an antithesis. And the synthesis will be a communist state, not governed by the majority, but by governed by all of the people. And that's a concept people cannot imagine in a democracy. Well, it's rule of the majority. No. Communism doesn't have that concept. That's off the table. And communism specifically prohibits the existence of a religion that is anywhere near supported by the state, because there you go. Then you're going to have that alienation starting all over again. You're going to have a power broker class and those who adhere to it to tell you what's right and what's wrong. Can't work like that. Marx said, workers of the world, unite. Don't listen to the capitalists. Don't listen to their middle class apologists. You have nothing to lose but your chains. And right now you are in chains. Rousseau said it first. Man is born free and everywhere he lives in chains. Well, I don't see no chains. I'm pretty happy right now. You are living in a world controlled by others who are better than you. They think they're better than you, and because of our system, their money makes them better than you. They can hire you when they want. They can fire you at pleasure. And now, even if you try to join a union, those are being destroyed right and left. You're being driven into a corner and being told the more you support the thesis, the more stable it will be, when in fact, the more you support that thesis, the more those seeds of destruction are flowering. By standing up for the rich, you aren't rich. Why are you doing that? This message is for those of you who refuse to live and die on your knees. History is not about conflict. Remember that. History is conflict. The last lesson I give to you tonight and for this course is, you all go out and make history. That's all.